headlines, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi says in order for the 2015 Iran deal to be revived in Vienna, the safeguards issues with the agency need to be resolved. Iran's security chief says Israel is the greatest enemy of the Muslim world in reaction to the Saudi crown prince calling Israel a potential ally. Plus, Russia opens humanitarian corridors, allowing time for civilians to leave two Ukrainian cities. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, says safeguards issues with Iran should be resolved in order for the 2015 nuclear deal to be revived. Grossi was speaking at a press conference with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization in Tehran. The IAEA chief said his talks with Mohammad Islami were fruitful and intense. Grossi said there is an understanding that the two sides should work together so that all issues are clarified. Grossi is due to meet with Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian on Saturday. His Tehran visit comes as Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal continue talks in Vienna to revive the accord. Those talks have now entered their final stage. And for an update on those talks, we are joined by our very own Homa Lezgi, live from Vienna. She's been keeping a close watch on the recent developments. Homa, can you give us an update on the talks? They're in the final stage. Could we be hopeful that a deal is within reach?
Yes, Gisu. So yesterday, of course, for those of our viewers who may be following these negotiations, we heard that the E3 representatives, the representatives of Britain, France, and Germany left for their capitals, but they said that they are going to be back very soon for the conclusion of these talks. The French delegate, for instance, said that we are hoping to return quickly to reach a conclusion because, in his words, we are very, very close to an agreement. And earlier, the British diplomat and delegate here also tweeting and saying that we are close and that the E3 negotiators are leaving Vienna briefly to update the ministers on the state of play, but they are ready to return soon. At the same time, the Iranian envoy and the delegation led by Mr. Bagheri Kani is still in Vienna, engaged in discussions. Last night, there were talks between the Iranians and the Russians. The Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, said that maybe, he's been quoted as saying in the media, that maybe in the middle of next week we can see the conclusion of these talks, as these last efforts are underway before we cross the finish line. Some media reports were speculating that we might actually have the foreign ministers arrive here in Vienna for the announcement on Sunday, but then that report was not confirmed. It could happen any time from now until the next few days. It looks like the decision is that there will be a joint commission session whereby the participants, excluding the U.S., of course, which is still not part of the joint commission or the JCPOA before implementation, they would announce the decision to restore the JCPOA, which will be endorsed also by the foreign ministers who are expected to be here, although no final decision or confirmation has been announced on those plans as of this minute. But from the latest that I can tell you regarding the disagreements or the sticking points, one of the sticking points is related, as you said, to this very important trip by the IAEA Director General, Rafael Mariano Grossi, to Tehran, the issue of Iran's safeguards, questions with regards to the agency and the resolution of these issues, because sources close to the Iranian teams have been saying that they don't want this case to be open in the IAEA and to be used as some kind of a leverage or a pressure tactic by the other participants when it comes to implementation of a restored JCPOA. Because, of course, if the JCPOA is implemented, the agency will have unprecedented access to Iran's nuclear activities. Iran will be again implementing the additional protocol, which gives the agency even broader access to even undeclared locations in Iran. So this is an important issue for the country. And we're also hearing that there are still some discussions taking place on the question of economic guarantees. that Iran wants from the U.S. Maybe there are some developments when it comes to the scope of sanctions that need to be removed. Nothing, of course, coming out officially. But there is hope now that indeed there is light at the end of this tunnel.
Well, that seems to be good news, and we'll be keeping in touch with Homa to get to the latest from Vienna. Moving on, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, calls Israel the biggest enemy of the Muslim world. Shamkhani made the comments in a tweet after the Saudi crown prince talked about the kingdom's relationship with the Israeli regime. Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh is looking for ways to coexist with Iran, but does not look at Israel as an enemy. He also said Tel Aviv will probably be an ally of Riyadh in the future. The top Iranian security official also referred to bilateral talks between Tehran and Riyadh. He said the talks hosted by Iraq stem from Iran's principled strategy of cooperating with its neighbors based on bilateral and regional interests. Those talks are aimed at defusing tensions over a host of issues, including the Yemen war. Academic and geopolitical policy analyst Alexander Azadgan says the Saudi crown prince's desire for ties with Israel is part of his game plan to survive amid international strife in the kingdom.
I think Mohammed bin Salman is coming to his senses in some way. He came to power in bloodshed as a deputy crown prince in 2015. And now he's got internal strife. Not too long ago, there was a possible palace coup by his brother, Bandar Salman. He feels cornered. He feels threatened. He has powerful enemies in Saudi Arabia. And that's why the Saudis in general are softening up. I don't think Iran should be so welcoming of them. And on the same token, obviously, Saudi Arabia and Israel could have their own diplomatic relationship. But when there's such enmity between Iran and Israel, and Israel is clearly taking advantage of the present situation where the global audience is completely focused on Russia and Ukraine, Israel is committing the most barbaric acts. We all see the videos of it, the clips of it, but they're pretty much getting away with it, because I would even argue that President Biden is even more of a Zionist than his ridiculous predecessor.
Meanwhile, Israel and the United Arab Emirates are boosting their ties further, with Abu Dhabi allowing Tel Aviv to resume a full schedule of flights to the Sheikhdom. Israel's internal spy agency, Shin Bet, says the two sides have settled a dispute over airport security that forced them to cut back air services. Israel's flag carrier, AI, has welcomed the announcement, saying that it will immediately return to operating up to 4 flights a day. Non-stop flights from Tel Aviv to Dubai were among the issues agreed upon as part of a U.S.-backed normalization deal between Israel and the UAE. That deal was clinched in 2020, drawing strong backlash from Muslims and Palestinians who see the accord as a betrayal of their cause. To Ukraine now, President Volodymyr Zelensky slams NATO for ruling out a no-fly zone over his country.
For 9 days, we have been seeing a fierce war. They are destroying our cities, shelling our people, our children, residential neighborhoods, churches, and schools. They are destroying everything that ensures a normal life, human life, and they want to continue it. Knowing that new strikes and casualties are inevitable, NATO deliberately decided not to close the sky over Ukraine.
Zelensky said NATO's rejection of an air exclusion zone comes as it knows more Russian attacks are likely. He said that this gives a green light to Russia to bomb more Ukrainian cities and villages. The Ukrainian president also described NATO's Friday summit on the issue as weak and confused. The Western military alliance rejected Kiev's calls for a no-fly zone over Ukraine amid Russia's military campaign in the country. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg warned that any such step would lead to a full-fledged war in Europe involving many more countries and causing more human suffering. And Moscow denies allegations that its forces shelled Europe's largest nuclear power plant in southeastern Ukraine. It follows a fire that erupted at the facility on Thursday after what Kiev called a Russian attack.
Today we have once again heard lies about how Russian troops attacked the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. And this is all part of an unprecedented campaign of lies and disinformation against Russia. You're trying to present the situation in such a way as though the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant was allegedly shelled by the Russian military, as a result of which a fire broke out.
The Russian ambassador made the remarks during an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. He said the meeting is another attempt by officials in Kiev to stir what he called artificial hysteria about the developments in Ukraine. He accused Ukrainian saboteurs of setting fire to the nuclear power plant following a battle with Russian troops near the facility. The Ukrainian ambassador, however, accused Moscow of lying. He said attacking the power plant could lead to a huge catastrophe.
If at any point the cooling process is disturbed, this could cause radioactive damage across large territories and have irreparable consequences for the environment of the entire continent. Thousands of people, including civilians, who are currently unable to evacuate the area near the plant due to ongoing shelling and fighting, would be affected.
The envoy urged the international community to stop the Russian military campaign as a common duty. He also called for the expulsion of Russia from international institutions. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. also accused Russia of having attacked the nuclear site. The ambassador said it was incredibly reckless and reflected a, quote, dangerous new escalation in Russia's assault on Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry announces a ceasefire to allow residents of two Ukrainian cities to evacuate. According to a ministry statement, the ceasefire has taken effect on 7 GMT Saturday in Mariupol and Vonovata. The ministry has not yet mentioned how long the truce will remain in effect in the two Ukrainian cities now surrounded by Russian forces. Russian media say the defense ministry has determined humanitarian corridors and exit points in an agreement with the Ukrainian authorities. The truce announcement came after Mariupol's mayor asked for humanitarian corridors, saying his city was under a blockade. Mariupol has about 500,000 population and is a strategic port city. EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, claims unprecedented sanctions being imposed by the West on Russia are not designed to oust Vladimir Putin. A series of emergency meetings have been taking place in Brussels to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Jerem Hughes reports.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert. and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainians, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service has warned that NATO countries are sending terrorists to Ukraine. The intelligence body says the terrorists have been trained at a U.S.-controlled military base in Syria. The agency also says the U.S. continues to form new terrorist groups in the Middle East and Africa to send them to Ukraine via Poland. In the meantime, British daily The Times has reported that Western mercenaries are offered $2,000 a day to fight Russia. According to the newspaper, private firms are recruiting former military agents for covert operations against Russian forces inside Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry has warned that all foreign mercenaries detained in Ukraine would be brought to justice in criminal charges. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The sudden concern for international law regarding Ukraine is nowhere to be found when it comes to Israeli regime's illegal occupation, an annexation of Palestinian and Syrian land, and its imposition of an apartheid regime on the entire Palestinian people, a crime against humanity, says Ali Abu Nima, journalist, in an article published under the heading Ukraine crisis highlights West hypocrisy over Israeli regime's land theft. Stay tuned for more. Just a day after Moscow recognized the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk from Ukraine, the European Union came out swinging against what it characterized as Russian aggression. The measure will also hit banks that are financing Russian military and other operations in those territories, and aim to thwart the ability of the Russian state and government to access the EU's capital and financial markets and services. These sanctions, likely to be followed by others, supposedly flow from the EU's deep respect for international law, as well as the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. The US is also laying out sanctions in response to what Washington describes as Russian invasion of the two eastern regions that have been under control of a pro-Russian separatist since 2014. Germany, which is largely dependent on gas supplies from Russia, announced the suspension of plans to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Washington's goal has been to bring Ukraine into the anti-Russia NATO military alliance, something Moscow sees as an existential threat and is strongly opposed by many among Ukraine's large ethnic Russian population. Yet the sudden concern for international law regarding Ukraine is nowhere to be found when it comes to the Zionist regime's illegal occupation and annexation of Palestinian and Syrian land, and its imposition of an apartheid regime on the entire Palestinian people, a crime against humanity. These Israeli regime's crimes could, of course, not be perpetrated without American and European support. When the Trump administration moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds in 2017, effectively recognizing the Zionist regime's illegal annexation of the city, the EU rejected the move. The EU also rejected the 2019 U.S. recognition of the Zionist regime's illegal annexation of Syria's occupied Golan Heights. Ironically, one of the handful of countries ready to follow the U.S. in recognizing the Zionist regime's illegal annexation of Al-Quds is none other than the U.S. and EU-backed government in Ukraine. Notably, the Biden administration has refused to rescind Trump's recognition of the Zionist regime's blatantly illegal acts, even as Washington blasts Russia for recognizing Donetsk and Luhansk. Indeed, Biden himself maintains an illegal U.S. occupation of parts of Syria. Under Trump, its explicit purpose was to plunder the country's oil. Yet the European Union, which has criticized both the US and Russia for their actions, has not imposed any sanctions on Washington for aiding and abetting the Zionist regime's crimes. That is hardly surprising. For decades, the European Union has acknowledged that the Zionist regime's occupation, theft, and annexation of Palestinian land is illegal. But instead of sanctioning it, Brussels rewards and encourages it. The stark contrast with the immediate American and EU resort to sanctions against Russia is not lost on Palestinians. Wassam Ahmad of the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq said recently, "For us as Palestinians, we see this discussion and we ask ourselves, where is this discussion when it comes to Palestine?" Ahmad was speaking during a webinar hosted by Finnish lawmaker Veronica Honkaslo, focusing on a bill she has introduced to ban trading goods from occupied territories. Ahmad observed, "The occupation of Palestinian territory has been going on for a much longer period of time." He said that the persistent lack of action in response to the Zionist regime's violation of Palestinian rights and international law undermines the credibility of the rule of law, being something that applies across the board. Frustrated with the complicity, hypocrisy, and unaccountability of their leaders, people across the continent are launching a European Citizens' Initiative to force Brussels to close European markets to products and services from settlements in occupied territories, including the Zionist colonies on Palestinian and Syrian lands. A European Citizens' Initiative is a formal process that is meant to allow citizens to influence EU policy. It requires gathering the signatures of at least 1 million people from across the bloc. This one has already passed the first hurdle of being formally registered by the European Commission, the EU's executive body. That came after the Commission had refused to register a similar initiative in 2019, a decision that was overturned last year when organizers went to court. Even though illegal settlements constitute a war crime under international law, the EU allows trade with them, said the European Legal Support Center, one of 100 organizations urging EU citizens to sign on to the initiative. Human Rights Watch, one of the several major human rights groups that over the last year have concluded that the Israeli regime perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid, is also backing the initiatives. Settlements unlawfully rob local populations of their land, resources and livelihoods, Bruno Stagno, chief advocacy officer at Human Rights Watch, stated, adding, "No country should be enabling the trade in goods produced as a result of land theft, displacement and discrimination." Frances Black, an Irish senator who sponsored legislation in her country to ban trade in settlement goods, is also urging support for the initiative. Although passed by the Irish Parliament, the government in Dublin is blocking the implementation of Black's Occupied Territories Bill. Meanwhile, the similar bill in Finland is coming up for the first vote. It has secured 35 sponsors out of Finland's 200 members of parliament. If it passes, this would be only the first step towards becoming law. More than 40 Palestinian human rights, political and cultural organizations have written to Finnish MPs. In a letter seen by the Electronic Intifada, they urge lawmakers to support the bill, calling it a crucial opportunity for Finland to lead by example on complying with relevant obligations under international human rights and international humanitarian law. Contrary to persistent Israel lobby complaints that the Zionist regime is being singled out, all these initiatives would ban trade in goods from any occupied territory, including Western Sahara, which is occupied by Morocco. In September, the European Court of Justice annulled an EU trade deal with Morocco because it included Western Sahara without the consent of its people and their internationally recognized representatives, the Polisario Front. During the recent seminar hosted by Finnish MP Honkasalo, Salah Abdul Muhammad, an advocate for Sahrawi self-determination, charged that the EU continues to allow the import of goods plundered from Sahrawi territory, such as sardines and tomatoes, that are falsely labeled as products of Morocco. The European Citizen Initiative that would stop trade with the Zionist regime settlement faces an enormous uphill battle. Of course, it would not even be necessary if EU governments really respected norms they now accuse Russia of violating. But time and again, international law proves not to be a yardstick against which all are measured, but a club used by the strong exclusively for their own advantage.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has said that Russia will carry out the operation until the end. What has prompted Russia to have such an aggressive stance towards Ukraine, which it says it is demilitarizing and denazifying and getting rid of dangerous nationals? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at other cases of wars and territorial gains, which the West has chosen not to highlight, displaying its double standards, like the war in Yemen, or Israel's land grab from Palestinians, or Syria's Golan Heights. Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have former U.S. diplomat and foreign policy analyst James Jatras, who joins us from Virginia. Also joining us, radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
James Jatras, first of all, welcome to you both. James Jatras, I'll start with you. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, the goal of this operation that it's executing against Ukraine, demilitarization and to achieve neutral status. He said it will be achieved. Demilitarization is understood. What do you think he means by neutral status?
It would be non-aligned status, I think, and that means that whatever is left of Ukraine after the detachment of the Donbass and perhaps other areas of the east and south into what will likely become a new state, is that what is left of a Ukrainian state will have to be non-aligned, in the sense that Finland, Sweden, and Austria were during the first Cold War. I don't think we can ignore the fact that there will now be, maybe for a generation, a new Cold War in Europe, and that Ukraine can be a neutral state under those circumstances, if it wants to exist at all. And that was essentially what Moscow was asking for the whole of Ukraine up till now. Security guarantees, the end of NATO expansion, neutrality, which now even Mr. Zelensky is willing to offer when it's rather too late for the state that he led.
Trying to understand what's going on, Tim Kirby, when it comes to the narratives here. Well, let's get to that in a minute. When we talk about demilitarization, Tim Kirby, maybe you could enlighten us as to what Russia is saying, because it's saying, listen, Ukraine is posing a threat to us. It's on our borders. But then you have the West, the U.S. and Germany, who has pumped in all these supplies to Ukraine. They keep giving supplies, military equipment to Ukraine. What is the goal there by doing that? I mean, do they want this war to continue? Isn't that one of the messages that it is sending?
Okay, your question has a few different levels here. Does the West want this war to keep going? Well, the West seems to have been very hostile towards Russia since since the beginning of time, it would seem. So, the more weapons that they can somehow send over to keep Russia's economy perhaps under pressure and keep Russian soldiers dying, they're thrilled with the option that works in their interests. Why the Russians want demilitarization is because they have a regime next to them that has carried out a lot of murders of Russian-speaking people, banned their language with no shame for 8 years, and that group of people, Zelensky said openly that he was considering pursuing nuclear weapons, and just today the Russians say that their intelligence has the proof that they were actually going to put together a nuclear arsenal and perhaps use it. So, you could see how Russia might want to keep whatever shape this future Ukrainian state looks like, to keep it relatively helpless, a helpless, neutral, open borderlands.
Yeah, this narrative that I spoke about minutes ago, which I didn't continue with that line, I want to ask you and start with you here, James Dutras, because we're getting, in essence, really somewhat two different narratives. When you have the Russian presidents and Russian officials, including the foreign minister, talk about how they want to denazify Ukraine, the role of Nazism and nationals that Russia continues to repeat. And even just the video that we played that was just in, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, said neo-Nazi units are using foreign mercenaries from the Middle East and are using civilians as human shields. We don't hear this in the Western media. We hear this coming from Russia. Tell us your take on what is going on here.
Well, you know, one of the problems with modern-day Ukraine as it emerged in 1991 is that it did not agree on its historical narrative, even to the point of whose side were you on during World War II? That you people in the West who sympathize with Mr. Bandera and the SS Galicia unit and all that, they were the good guys as far as they were concerned. And most people in East Ukraine did not have that feeling at all, that they supported the Soviet Union in the war against Nazi Germany. You know, there's an element of hyperbole in talking about Nazis in Ukraine, but underlying it is a very real thing, which is there are very radical groups that have extreme nationalist views that essentially hold this government in Kiev hostage. Remember, Mr. Zelensky won in 2019 on a peace platform with the entire country voting for him. 70% of the vote landslide, except for the very far west, which is where these groups are concentrated. However, when you talk about Pravi Sektor, the Azov Battalion, these are groups that essentially make it impossible for any government in Kiev to pursue a more moderate course, make it impossible for them to negotiate with the Donbass republics as required under the Minsk II agreement. So in a way, this thing was baked into the cake, that there was a state that was paralyzed by these radical groups. And also you had the complete flat refusal of Washington and NATO to discuss Russia's security concerns, particularly the first or further expansion of NATO. You know, if the West had pursued a different course and said, sure, we'll talk about that. NATO doesn't need to expand anymore. Yes, Kiev must talk to the Donbass republics. Let's make that happen. This would not have happened. Now, I think Moscow knew that there would not be any positive response in that respect. And frankly, I think there are people in the West who really wanted this outcome so they could demonize Russia, force Russia out of European affairs, keep the Germans and the French under Washington's thumb, and sell a lot of weapons in the meantime. What's not to love?
Okay, now that is perhaps something that needs either your agreement or disagreement on, Tim Kirby. What do you think about the last statement made there? Maybe that is an outcome that Washington perhaps wanted in terms of what we're seeing unfold.
Well, if you're talking about making money off of war, I think the prime example of this would be that a member of the Atlantic Council, his name slips my memory for the moment, but he wrote a piece for Foreign Policy that basically said that the United States needs to prepare for war, not just against Russia, but also against China right now. And what's the solution? What is that form of preparation for this super war? Doubling the U.S. military budget. So that would be from about $750 billion as it is now a year to $1.5 trillion. Let the corruption train roll, you know. So, yeah, there's definitely a monetary element to all of this. Of course, it's maybe not the real underlying total motivation, but it certainly pushes towards the necessity for war. That's for sure.
Well, James Dutras, we can't help but talk a little bit about the economic strain that this is putting on the world and the respective countries, including Russia. Russia, however, my question is, seems to have calculated its pre-launch stature in terms of trying to somewhat cushion or prepare for this. What is your view about the extreme sanctions that are placed on Russia? And, of course, what the world is experiencing, Europe and the U.S. are not exempt, obviously, on a whole variety of sectors that you're seeing price surges. I mean, is that coming at the expense of people, to say the least?
Of course it is. And this is where we are getting into the fact that there is a full-scale confrontation between the West and Russia now. There are actually several wars going on right now. One is the military action on the ground. There's a reason why the Western media are misrepresenting the military war and saying, oh, the Russians are behind schedule. They're meeting stiff resistance. They're attacking the civilian population. You notice you don't even see any reports of the electricity going out in Ukraine. Unlike when we attack a country, whether it's Serbia or Iraq or Libya, and the first thing we do is knock out all of the infrastructure, the electrical system and the water and the communications and everything else, the bridges and the roads and the rail. They're not doing that. They're not trying to destroy Ukraine. They're trying to encircle. They're trying to kill too many Ukrainian soldiers. They're trying to encircle them and give them the option of surrendering because they want to be able to, as they said, denazify Ukraine, install a more friendly government, allow maybe some of the eastern and southern regions to form a new state if they wish to do that, but not to actually destroy the place like we have a habit of destroying countries. We're also seeing the economic war, which is going to have very significant blowback in Western countries, less so in the United States, more so in Europe, where they're not going to have access to Russian energy, raw materials, metals, agriculture. And this is going to be a real problem. But most of all, what the West is fighting, an information war to make the Russians out. You know, what we saw with the demonization of Milosevic or Assad or Gaddafi or whoever it is, we're going to see that to the nth degree in this, and that's really the war that's being fought. And that's why I fear a huge false flag atrocity of some sort is in preparation now.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about the double standards, Tim Kirby, we can talk about, of course, how Joe Biden, when he was a senator, how he promoted, war on Iraq, of which he's now saying, you know, this is not something that needs to happen. However, we're seeing what he's promoting when it comes to Ukraine. Another double standards that are at play here, where perhaps maybe you can tell us, of course, the U.S.-led NATO war in Libya is one prime example, the war in Yemen. I mean, enlighten us as to how these double standards are unfolding and why the media is reaching out to the viewers on an emotional level when these other scenarios can also be reached out to viewers on an emotional level also.
Well, the source of where these double standards come from is generally people who believe in a certain double standard, not just in international relations, but even in their personal lives. It's generally because they have a complete and total lack of respect for the other party. They can't perceive what this other party thinks or does. So they feel that this double standard is completely fine because they have no concern for what the other is thinking. And that's exactly what is happening here. The United States generally, because it could not care less about what others or outsiders think or do. It sees all of its actions as part of some sort of overall noble pursuit or some sort of global police work, whereas any military actions pursued against their interests are part of some sort of magical axis of evil. It's sort of the dark side of human nature, especially human nature that is a very, very low view of other people, especially Russians.
James Dutrous, looking at the bigger picture here, there's been in the past decade or even longer this world order that we hear about, the new world order. I'm guessing that this may be, again, a new world order when you take a look at, for lack of a better word, the decoupling that's taking place, Russia from the West, at least at this stage. What are we looking at in terms of that? Is this something that's really going to change the way that Russia is going to interact in the world or decouple from the West, U.S. and Europe? And what is that going to entail? What is it going to look like?
Absolutely. It's a new, if you will, a new world order that we're looking at now. And it can go one of two ways. And I think this is why Mr. Lavrov said today that Russia will see this through militarily to the end. That I don't think that they will get sidetracked on trying to restrain themselves in the hopes that the other side will behave reasonably. I think they decided to cross that Rubicon when they got no action at all, no response at all to their ultimatum of December 17th. I think what's one of two things are going to happen. Either the Russians will press this on to the point of victory, and at that point, the world would be confronted with a fait accompli. This is what Russia has now done in its vital national interest. It has reordered a country that actually was, in a way, a lot far less destructive than we have destroyed other countries for no national gain, or it's possible they fail. And then if they do that, and Russia then is subordinated to the globalist system coming from the West, yes, the unipolar world will continue then at that point, and of course its next target will be China. And so it could go that way. I don't think it will. I think it's more likely that the Russians will prevail, that Washington will be presented with this new reality, and that we will have willy-nilly the emergence of a multipolar world.
Sure. Well, one country that I'm sure is looking, Tim Kirby, at all of this is China. And I'm sure Russia, I mean, prior to this military operation, Russia and China came out, if you recall, during the Winter Olympics, they came out and made a strong statement standing up to NATO, and of course the U.S. by default, in a sense. Are we looking at that bond, if it was any closer, to even become ever closer in terms of both economic and military spheres, and Russia moving further east?
Well, on the economic level, I mean, Russia's just been more or less blocked from every major Western corporation that we can think of. Some of these may be actually good in the long run, like getting rid of McDonald's, but others could be very difficult, like losing the ability to get processors from Taiwan. So in a lot of ways, China is going to kind of pick up the slack from Europe's products for Russia to go forward into the future. And this symbiosis between Russia and China, if it works out, it'll be good. But if China blinks or changes their mind or gets skittish, Russia could be in a lot of trouble because although the Russian economy is pretty good and Russia produces a lot of the things that are at the store, it doesn't produce 100% of it, and they could be in trouble. I think the real war now within Russia that has to be won, defeating the Ukrainian military is a joke. Russia's using less than 5% of its total might to deal with this problem, and it's winning heavy or completely. The military side is easy. The tough side is the economics. That's where the real battle is going to be, and China will be a massive, massive help in this process, again, if they don't happen to change their mind or get skittish or whatnot.
Well, do you think that China's going to blink, James Dutras?
I could be wrong, but I don't think we say that Russia has taken this all into the account before they launched the operation. Remember that statement that came from President Xi and President Putin a few weeks ago? I think the Chinese realize, too, that they have to brass this out along with the Russians, or else they're in a very bad position. You know, China's the only economy on the planet that's comparable to the American economy. Russia's is the only military power on the planet that is comparable to ours. The two of them together having each other's back, Eurasia is a real counterbalance and rival to the power of the United States and our various satellites around the world. If one of them goes down and the other one is then faced with a confrontation with Washington all by itself, that's not good. And I think the Chinese know that, and they don't want to be caught in that position.
Well, trying to figure out here some of the stances that NATO is going to take and the European sides, which we're seeing at this point, based on how it's being reported, Tim Kirby, that NATO is more unified than ever. European countries are now, like Germany, who are going to spend so much more money on their defense. Even as you said, if Russia completes its military operation and reaches its objectives, won't the tensions still exist? In other words, doesn't there need to be some kind of settlement on this issue or issues in order for there to be, peace, in order for there to be coexistence, in other words?
Well, there's always going to be tension between Russia and continental Europe, and especially the Anglo-Saxons beyond. That is always the way it's going to be. It has been that way for centuries. It was even that way when Peter the Great had to deal with the Swedes. This is not anything new. This is the way the world works. I should remind people that this whole concept of a multipolar world is not a world of pacifism. It's a world that has a lot of peace in it. Hopefully it'll be very pleasant to live in, but it's not centered around the idea that it'll be the end of all wars and all conflicts. Stress is always going to be there. Russia has been, probably since the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox churches split, Russia was never going to be welcome back in Europe, and it still hasn't to this day. As in Putin, when he was explaining the whole logic of this intervention to the Russian public, he even mentioned that in the 90s, for the first time he mentioned this openly and confirmed something that was a rumor, you know, Russia told NATO, okay, we're ready. We're ready to join. We're kind of ready to be part of the West. You got us. You defeated us. We're your vassals now. We'll go serve you. And NATO said no, just because they're Russian, they're different, they're not Europeans. That hatred, that geopolitical aspect, the cultural divide is not going to go anywhere. It's been there for hundreds of years. It's going to still be there tomorrow.
James Watrous, my final question to you at this point is regarding this military operation that Russia is executing. It has said that we're not interested in putting and installing a government there. So what are Russia's plans when it comes to that? I mean, would it be directly involved once and if, we're assuming that it will, at least Tim Kirby has indicated as such, that it's going to, you know, be successful. What future plans does Russia have for that, if any, for the future government there in Kiev, if that was to be the case?
Well, if their goal is not regime change, I wonder why they bother. Yes, of course it has to be regime change. I hope these talks that are going on in Belarus are simply a smokescreen, and they're simply going to continue their operation until the people sitting across the table from them become clear they're not representing any government that in fact exists. And then some new order will take place there. Now, you know, maybe Mr. Zelensky or other people currently in the Ukrainian government could be part of that once they realize that they have no other options. And maybe when they feel freed from the pressure of these more radical national elements that have been disposed of. But I think if Russia were to somehow stop before completely remaking the Ukrainian state, it would be a horrible mistake on their part, and they would be simply saving themselves up for an even worse conflict in the future, which is actually what I think they're seeking to avoid.
And Tim Kirby, final question to you. You're saying Russia is using 5% of its capabilities. The Russian foreign minister has said that it seems like NATO is interested in having a third world war, and also that would entail nuclear use of nuclear weapons. How much of a possibility do you think that is to come?
Well, just to explain
reality?
One thing. Again, this what he said is coming from a Russian standpoint, where from the West, what Russia's doing seems like some sort of surprise or aggression or randomness. But really, NATO has kept the pressure on Russia, whether Russia was the Soviet Union, the big enemy, whether it was during the Yeltsin period, where it was a complete submissive vassal, during the early Putin period as a sort of semi-friend, and now whatever the relationship is now. The thing is, it consistently always keeps the pressure on Russia. So I think, in a sense, what they're trying to say is that overall attitude and that continuous pressure, it really opens the door to a World War III sort of scenario. If NATO were to have backed off, or especially if NATO would have absorbed Russia in the 1990s, well, then that situation would be impossible today, wouldn't it?
Well, end it there. Thank you very much for that. Tim Kirby from Moscow, radio host and political analyst. James Watrous, thank you for your contribution from Virginia, former U.S. diplomat and foreign policy analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's great tip, our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah, and overlooking the self in order to see the divine.
Allah, Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, we're talking about ubudiyya, we're talking about the servitude to Allah, we're talking about the worship of Allah, and we're talking about the obedience to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the Creator and the Sustainer. Now, one of the things that we are taught by the spiritual masters, the urafa, if you will, they teach us that we will have to overlook the self if we want to see the divine. If all of our attention is towards the self, myself, me, I, then how will we ever be able to see the divine? How will we ever be able to feel Allah, to recognize Allah, to really feel the presence of Allah? And so we are taught in order to increase, enhance, strengthen our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah, that the salik, the spiritual wayfarer, must overlook their own behaviors and their own manners. And as Imam Khomeini says, they must be completely submitted to the kingdom of the existence of Allah. And so what happens is that you leave the house, this heart, this soul, to its real owner, who is Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And eventually one becomes perished in the glory of Allah's lordship. And the owner of the house, the owner of this body and this mind and this soul, himself begins to manage the affairs of that which he owns. And so very quickly, just to try to explain this, because it is quite profound, it is quite deep, and it is quite complex as well. Here we overlook our own behaviors. So what does this perhaps mean? When we overlook our own behaviors and our own preferences, we have to put this into context with what are we focusing on when we are overlooking these. Make sense? So it can't be that we are overlooking all behaviors and all manners, because then we aren't going to do anything.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Muftariqin, meaning the whispered prayer of the utterly poor. Stay tuned. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, O utmost hope of the hopers, O ultimate demand of the askers, O furthest request of the requesters, O highest desire.